From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Oscar-winning screenwriter and executive producer of ABC's American Crime, John Ridley, talks about his latest projects. And musician Julian Lennon discusses his new children's book, Touch the Earth. But first, President Trump's decision to launch airstrikes against Syria and drop the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan revealed how quickly he's willing to shift his position on U.S. foreign policy. These moves have attracted criticism at home and abroad. What can we expect from the president's flexible approach to international politics in the long term? To help us unpack all of this and more, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof. He's also a best-selling author of several books, including Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Nick, good to have you on the program.
Good to be with you.
Before I jump into all these crises, can I just tell you, I was reading your brilliant conversation with President Carter. And the title was, Am I a Christian? A question that you posed to President Carter. I love the questions that you ask him. I love even
more. Pretty tough questions,
there were some very tough questions, and I love the answers that President Carter gave. I'm just curious what kind of response you've gotten to that column.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was really an outpouring of just warmth toward President Carter.
Yeah.
And it followed a previous kind of similar conversation in which I'd asked Tim Keller, mm-hmm. who's a very, very prominent evangelical thinker, and I'd asked similar questions, and he had given a much kind of a tougher, hardline approach, mm-hmm. and he basically said, no, you're not a Christian if you don't believe in miracles. And and Jimmy Carter was took a very different approach, mm-hmm. much less willing to judge, and much more inclusive approach. And so I think the reaction depended a lot on one's theology.
Sure.
There's just so much respect for Jimmy Carter, and I mean, at least I think that we in the media truly wronged him when he was president.
Yeah. I asked Jimmy Carter in this very chair one time as a guest on this program whether or not he thought, as some do, that he was the best ex-president that we ever had. He's my friend. He took some exception to the question, but he gave me an honest answer. He says, Tavis, maybe I am the best ex-president, but I also think I did a pretty decent job as president. Since you raised it, in retrospect, why do you think we wronged Jimmy Carter? And I asked that in part because the one thing that he mentioned in terms of what he had done that he thought was pretty great was that he did not get us engaged in any wars around the world, didn't fire a single bullet during his 4 years of presidency. So what do you make of why we were so tough on Jimmy Carter?
You know, I think there was a certain amount of snobbishness on the part of the media and on the part of the Washington establishment. Here's this peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, mm-hmm. showing up. And so I think part of it was just that kind of snobbishness. I also think that in the media we have a weakness for narratives, and that once the narrative was started that he was kind of a weakling, that then we in the media looked for bits of evidence to support that. And there were, I don't know, do you remember the famous rabbit episode?
Of course, absolutely. Absolutely.
That was us at our worst.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
he's in mm-hmm. a pond, mm-hmm. and then word spreads that a rabbit has tried to jump on his boat, and all of a sudden we're reporting that, you know, a rabbit has attacked him. And he very unfairly became something of a joke when, in fact, looking back, he was really the first president to raise human rights internationally mm-hmm. in a big way and in a lasting way. He solved the Panama Canal problem, which would have haunted the United States for decades to come. And you know, in other hands, we might have ended up in a war with Iran. You know, the economy was bad for reasons that didn't have anything mm-hmm. to do with him, but with the rise in oil prices. And I think we were profoundly unfair to him.
Yeah. So to my question to him, how good an ex-president has he been?
Oh, he is the best.
Yeah.
I mean, he is the best. Diseases like river blindness are about as awful a disease as you can get. It's a parasite that gnaws away at the optic nerve. And because of Jimmy Carter, more than almost anybody else, it's not eradicated, but it is on its way out. And there have been vast parts of West Africa, for example, that people can now farm again that nobody ever could before because they didn't dare to live in these places because everybody went blind by middle age. His work on international peace mm-hmm. and disease, he is about to, because of him, we're about to eradicate a disease called Guinea worm, mm-hmm. which is one of the more painful, humiliating diseases globally. And it's because of his incredible work that it is, you know, this may be the last year in human history that guinea worm has bothered people.
So let me pivot then from Jimmy Carter to Donald Trump. As I said a moment ago, one of the things that Carter is most proud of, President Carter, is that he did not fire a single bullet while he was president for 4 years, which stands in great contrast to Mr. Trump, who, you know, who theoretically could drop 3 bombs in a matter of weeks on 3 different countries. What do you make of what he has done as juxtaposed against the promises that he made on the campaign trail? How do you read this military exploration that he has gone on?
Well, I think that he actually was right to have military strikes on Syria after the use of chemical weapons there. I think that one of the important taboos to uphold, it's lasted 100 years more or less, has been the one against the use of chemical weapons. And I think that he indeed probably made President Assad a little less likely to use chemical weapons. But having said that, I do worry that the lesson that President Trump will learn is that if he wants to raise his poll numbers, firing a few missiles will do it. And while I think it made sense in that context of Syria using chemical weapons, I don't think that it would make sense in attacking the port of Hodeidah in Yemen, which is something that I think the administration is thinking about. Mm-hmm. And it would even make less sense in the case of North Korea, where, you know, as I think about things that could go badly wrong in the next 4 years, North Korea, preemptive attack on North Korea is just about at the top of the list.
Why so?
North Korea is the problem from hell. It really does present us with a serious challenge, and the path we're on is not sustainable because they are developing both increasing number of nuclear warheads and the missiles that would give them the ability to deliver them to the continental U.S. So the present path is not sustainable, and so that creates a temptation to turn to a military response. And the theory among some people in Washington is that if we were to attack a missile launch, for example, or a nuclear test site, and warn North Korea that if you respond, that's the end of your regime, that they would accept that. Maybe they would, but the risk is that they would, they have 13,000 artillery tubes aimed at Seoul, which has a metro area of 25 million people. There was one military study in the 1990s that suggested that in the event of a new Korean War, there could be 1 million casualties. Mm-hmm. And my fear is that we would launch such a limited strike and North Korea would respond by devastating Seoul and also by firing missiles at Tokyo, which it could hit, that it might apply chemical or biological weapons, which it has several thousand tons of sarin and VX gas. And it would be an extraordinarily devastating incident for South Korea and for Japan and for the world economy. We would win the war quite quickly. Mm-hmm. We would be able to topple the North Korean regime very easily. But the human cost, mm-hmm. economic cost, would be catastrophic.
So if you think that Trump, President Trump, was right to do what he did in Syria, do I take it then you think Obama was wrong to have not done more when Assad crossed over his line?
I do. Okay. Oh, actually, not at that moment. I think right. that President Obama makes a good case that the deal that he struck at that moment to remove mm-hmm. most chemical weapons from Syria was a good one. I think he makes a pretty good case there. But when Hillary Clinton, David Petraeus, various other people were suggesting supporting the moderate rebels mm-hmm. as they existed then, I think that he should have done more at that time. And I think that also as things went on that we could have taken out some of the airstrips in Syria that President Assad was using to drop barrel bombs on the Syrian people. I think that the reason President Obama didn't was frankly that early on it seemed as if President Assad was losing ground, that he would be toppled anyway. And so it seemed, you know, why get involved? But that was a reasonable thing to think in at that time, but it proved to be a misjudgment. In fact, Assad proved to have more staying power than we'd expected, and of course Russia came in to help him in a big way.
Yep. Let me do what I should not do, ask a 3-part question, but I want to okay. get it out of the way so you can handle it. So in Syria, is it one and done? Should it be one and done? And if not, what should be done next? Because as I hear the Trump administration, I'm hearing more talk about regime change.
I think that it will probably be one and done. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of easy talk in Washington about regime change.
Yeah.
How do we go about that? Assad, you know, maybe Assad will collapse tomorrow, but we've
done it before.
Yeah, but we, but taking
I'm not bragging about that. I'm just saying that we've done it too many times before.
And hopefully we've learned some lessons from that. Taking out President Assad would be immensely complicated. I don't think that we have the political will to do that. It's not clear what would follow. And so I hope that we're not going to take on that burden of attempting regime change. Now, what I would like to see is something in between one and done and overthrowing the regime, which is to take out his air capacity by striking some airstrips, taking out some of his aircraft so that he won't be able to drop barrel bombs, and it'll limit his air capacity. And then the idea is that then if he sees that there is no military solution, that he may be a little bit more willing to negotiate some kind of a long-term ceasefire that is a de facto partition of the country. Now, will this work? You know, we don't know. Are there risks? Absolutely. But 400,000 people have died in Syria, and there are real risks of doing nothing as well.
So long as Vladimir Putin is his best friend, Mr. Assad, he might not be motivated to do much of anything over and against whatever the U.S. wants him to do, which leads me to ask what then you make of the quandary that puts the Trump administration in now with its relationship with Russia, which has changed dramatically from what we thought it was going to be just a few weeks ago.
That's right. I mean, it's astonishing. We used to, you know, pretty not so long ago, we were worried about lifting sanctions against Russia.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought it was interesting to see Rex Tillerson's trip to Moscow. I thought for the first time, he really did seem to be acting as a Secretary of State. And I'd been concerned that we basically didn't really have a Secretary of State, that he finally kind of emerged in that role.
It was Jared Kushner, but I digress.
Well, yeah, well, that's true. And, you know, one of the larger problems in Syria is that issue of do we have a real Secretary of State? Mm-hmm. John Kerry was pleading with the White House for some military strikes to give him leverage to achieve a peace deal. Well, now we finally have that military power, but we don't have a Secretary of State who wants to use that leverage for peace. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's a missed opportunity. I hope that Rex Tillerson will grow further into the role, but I'm a little skeptical. And where our relationship with Moscow goes, American foreign policy now seems to be, you know, if it's Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, then it's this, and Tuesdays and Thursdays it's that, and then on the weekends it's something else entirely.
Yeah. How do we get to, that's actually the wrong question, not how we get to, will we get to a place where we think we have a clear understanding of what the Trump doctrine is, or do you think that there are already some signs that are leading us in a particular direction? Because to your point, the policy is so schizophrenic now.
That's
not
right.
Just from the not just in terms of what they do, but in terms of who you're talking to on any given day, that I don't know that there's any sort of cohesive, comprehensive strategy at this point.
Tavis, I think you're entirely right, and I don't think we're going to see that emerge. I mean, I think that the Trump doctrine, to the extent it is going to emerge, is going to be based on who the last person was who talked to President Trump, and secondly, what seems most likely to promote his poll ratings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether domestically or in foreign policy, he's not ideological. Mm-hmm. I think he's very much shaped by the last person he talked to, and just kind of almost what mood he's in. I mean, you look at his relations with China. Mm-hmm. We started off with a two-China policy, and then somehow we're back at a one-China policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is true that I think there's been some maturation of his foreign policy, and the reality has caught up with him. We are certainly much better off with the foreign policy team today, with General McMaster as National Security Advisor, with Jim Mattis at the Pentagon. They are both, you know, they're grown-ups in the room. Steve Bannon has been brought down a peg in national security issues. Mike Flynn, who was a disaster, is gone. So I feel I can sleep a little more safely at night now than when the Trump administration began in terms of foreign policy.
Since you intimated this a moment ago, let me ask explicitly whether or not you think, even if you think that President Trump was right to do what he did in Syria, do you think it was a weapon of mass distraction from all the other stuff that he's dealing with here at home?
I don't know, but that has certainly occurred to me. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, frankly, Tavis, I worry about is that, you know, while I approved of that strike, and a lot of liberals did, I fear that that creates an incentive for him, or makes him think that the road to greater popularity or approval is to fire off more missiles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that would be a pretty catastrophic narrative for him to absorb.
Yeah. There were also, as you will acknowledge, a lot of progressives who thought it was not the right thing to do, because in fact it would lead to what we're seeing now, which is that this guy would become trigger happy. So to those progressives who say, Nick Kristof, we love you, we read your stuff, but you were wrong about that, and those liberals who agree with you are wrong about that, we progressives who were against it are right, because now you have a trigger happy president.
And I think that's a compelling argument, and I understand that. But, you know, I'm motivated, I think, having reported in Syria, having spent so much time with Syrian refugees, it's striking that Syrian refugees themselves overwhelmingly applauded this action. And indeed, I thought that the best thing that President Obama did in Syria was a military strike that I think few people have heard of. But in Mount Sinjar, he had a limited military strike that averted a genocide against the Yazidi people. And so the problem is how one conveys the idea that sometimes a limited military strike in context makes sense and can even save lives, as it did at Mount Sinjar, and as I think was beneficial in this case, and yet not see the military as the tool that is going to solve all problems or that is going to elevate one's own damaged popularity. Mm-hmm. And to those critics who see that as a risk, I point well taken. Mm-hmm.
To the extent that he has won, what then do these crises, what impact do they have on his domestic agenda?
I guess another of my concerns is that I think that in the domestic agenda, there are a lot of checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And I think he's seeing that it's, you know, healthcare turns out to be more complicated than he knew. And I don't think he's going to, I'd be surprised if we see a major tax reform package, because again, I think it'll be really hard to put together a consensus there. Infrastructure maybe is a little more doable, but frankly will also be tough. Those checks and balances largely don't exist in foreign affairs. Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that the president feels stymied domestically and is much less constrained internationally, I guess I worry that he might become, over time, a little bit more of a prone to adventures abroad for political reasons and partly because it's the path of least resistance. And this, you know, I've interviewed lots of politicians over the decades. And I can't think of a national politician that I have ever met who has been so unfamiliar with policy details, or even as uninterested in policy details as our president.
If these escapades, military or otherwise, around the world end up taking his eye off the ball from his domestic agenda, at least the one that he promised to those persons who supported for him, what ultimately happens to the faith that those supporters had in him when they elected him? Does he pay a price for that?
If the economy doesn't improve, and in particular if jobs don't come back, then at some point I think he will pay a price. But I don't think that he will pay a price for a lot of things that, frankly, I think he should. And there are a number of policies that he's pursuing that are going to hurt his base. And I think that he's not going to pay that price. I was in Oklahoma recently interviewing a whole series of Trump voters who were upset about how his budget cuts would hurt programs they really appreciated. Yet every one of them said they still supported President Trump and were still open to voting for him for re-election. One of the problems, frankly, is that we're so polarized as a nation right now that Trump voters, I think, feel to some degree defensive, mm-hmm. and that when Democrats come across as patronizing and accusing them of being dumb bigots, that makes it harder to let go of President Trump.
Let me go to the other side. Hillary Clinton, the opponent of one Donald Trump, she's made a couple of appearances of late. I saw her in New York at a signing ceremony with Governor Cuomo about free education. And then she spoke at the Big Women in the World conference. And I think you are the only journalist to date who has actually interviewed her. You spoke to her at that conference. What sense did you get from her? What did she say to you? How is she?
You know, I thought she was actually doing pretty well, mm-hmm. and that she seemed so much more relaxed and at ease than she had in the campaign.
I mean, they always are when it's over.
That's
Al Gore is best example.
That's actually a good example. That Al Gore as a candidate was stiff and formal and had this shell around him as a candidate that smothered his authenticity, mm-hmm. and his power as a candidate. Likewise, I think Hillary Clinton had been attacked so much for so many reasons, mm-hmm. that she developed this protective shell that weakened her charm as a candidate, mm-hmm. and it was really good to see that I think she's shed that shell and she's back to herself. And I asked her if she was planning to run again. She pretty definitively said no, and she was pretty blunt about some things, about the role of misogyny in
her loss,
her defeat,
which
I don't think she would have said if she was planning, mm-hmm. to run for office again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you, now that you're with her at 3 o'clock in the morning when she wakes up perhaps and sheds tears, I don't know, but how did you sense her spirit to be?
She said, and I think I take her at her word, that she's kind of worked her way through that, mm-hmm. that it was really rough at the beginning, and that she was spending a lot of time walking in the woods, sorting things out, but that friends came through. Spending time with grandkids, mm-hmm. gives one perspective, sure. on what's important in life. And she said that, you know, she's now out of the woods. And it felt like that's true. It felt like she's come to terms with it. She was expecting to win. She was expected to be president. She prepared for it. And then it slipped through her fingers. It's a hard thing to come to terms with. But at this point, I think she has as much as anybody can.
The irony of all this is, as we close this conversation, is that had she won, at least on Syria, there'd be no distinction between what Trump did and what she did. That's the ultimate irony.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I asked her about that, and she, this was a few hours before Trump's strike, and she essentially prescribed the same action that President Trump took.
I digress. Mr. Kristof, good to have you on the program,
sir. Hey, good to be with you.
Good to see you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. John Ridley is the Oscar-winning screenwriter of the film 12 Years a Slave and the executive producer of ABC's American Crime. He's been hard at work on several new projects, a documentary called Let It Fall, Los Angeles 1982 to 1992, which explores the 1992 uprising, and the Showtime series Guerrilla, which focuses on the British Black Power movement of the 1970s.
Before our conversation, here now a clip from Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992.
It's not a protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
Anybody that wasn't black was getting their ass kicked.
I mean, it was just one of those days. Compassion was, it wasn't handed out to other races.
I was in the boxing gym. Telling my guys that you were coming on the program, and you could almost sense the shock from the guys in the gym when I reminded them that this is the 25th anniversary. It was just hard for people to process that that was 25 years ago. How did you feel digging into this 25 years later?
It was odd. I had just moved out to Los Angeles. You know, 25 years, when you think about a quarter of a century, that this is not just history anymore, it's moving towards ancient history. Mm-hmm. You know, this is past my kids' time. There are people you meet, they barely remember the uprising, let alone the events around it. To a lot of people, it's just become, you know, Rodney King, Reginald Denny, mm-hmm. and that's it. And what we wanted to do, what we hoped to do, was not just put that night or that year into some kind of context, but to say there was a wider context. You know, we could have gone back 15 years, mm-hmm. 25 years, but with at least 10 years and say these events and these circumstances, it wasn't just one thing. It didn't just happen to one community. People didn't just react one way. Mm-hmm. You made a very interesting comment about that. But that's what we want to approach in the documentary, is to say there were a lot of things going on, and there are a lot of reasons why they were going on.
How does that context, that broader context, John, inform the story that you do tell?
For me, you know, look, having just moved out here, not being an Angeleno originally, coming from New York, which was, when I left, it was Bernie Goetz and Howard Beach mm-hmm. and Crown Heights mm-hmm. and a lot of things that really informed my perspective. 25 years later, to say, well, it's a lot less about me or what I think or what I remember mm-hmm. and a lot more about trying to provide a space for people to have their own recollections and talk about what happened. Because 25 years later, I get to move on or have different opinions mm-hmm. or different perspectives. For the people that we talked to, 25 years ago was 5 minutes ago. It was 5 hours ago. Mm-hmm. And to sit this far away from individuals from all different backgrounds and have them tell their stories and share it with an emotion that was so immediate. You know, I've been very fortunate to have been able to express bits of history, whether it's Red Tails or 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that, you know, it's still my expression of someone else's history. A documentary is very different. Yeah. It's creating a space where individuals get to express their recollections for themselves.
I was struck by the former LAPD officer, the white woman. Yeah. We saw in the clip a moment ago, who said that if you weren't black, you were getting your behind kicked.
Yeah.
All right. It's a bit of an exaggeration. Not everybody who wasn't black got their behind kicked, but I take her point. But it leads me to ask whether or not, when one sees this documentary, whether or not, not to put you in the seat of judging how white people will view this, but generally speaking, broadly speaking, when they see this, are they going to leave celebrating and reveling in the humanity of black people, or further demonizing black people?
I hope that they look at the humanity of all people, but certainly people of color, because there are going to, look, there are going to be people who arrive to this, or quite frankly, anything I do, I've learned, with their agendas already in place.
Sure.
But within this space, I think we have enough voices and enough perspectives and see enough people that reacted in their own ways that they will not walk away saying, well, those people only did that, or they did that. There's a reason why, for me now, at least in this space, why we're not using the word riot here. Mm-hmm. And I don't ever want to get into a war of semantics. People can use this word or can't use that word. But this was not something that happened spontaneously overnight because of one thing. Mm-hmm. Over this period of 10 years, we can see individuals who tried to engage in the system, who tried to get recourse, who tried to call attention to issues, who put up with a lot of things up until a moment where individuals felt there was no other way to express themselves. And even that didn't begin spontaneously just because of the verdict. There were other incidences. So I think and believe, without explaining exactly what happens at the end, that there are going to be moments where people will see their humanity. But ultimately, all we can do is build an apparatus for delivering empathy and how people walk away, you know, whether it's one community, whether it's people in uniform or out of uniform or other communities. All we can do is say, look, these are the bodies of stories.
As you know, I worked for Tom Bradley when he was mayor of this city, and I was there when that ugly tension existed between the mayor and Daryl Gates, born, from my perspective at least, largely of the disrespect that Chief Gates had for the mayor of this city, Tom Bradley. That's my own personal assessment. What then of the other actors in this drama over that 10-year period, beyond the folks who we saw in the streets?
Yeah. We see police officers. We see people from the black community, not just from South Central. I mean, one of the things, I think a lot of people who've never been to Los Angeles couldn't tell you where Foothill was, couldn't tell you where South Central, Westwood, Koreatown. We want to get all of those various communities and over time, but also look at moments in LA, you know, going from 82 to 92 to be able to look at least in the documentary version, mm-hmm. in the full length version, you know, 1984, and look at Tom Bradley and look at what he meant to the city, mm-hmm. look at what his vision, how it actually helped change the city, in moments where there was a better LA completely inevitable. But under the surface, whether it's Los Angeles or other cities, and we don't necessarily want to draw a direct comparison, mm-hmm. but if we're not looking at every aspect of it, if we're just looking at the facade, then we're missing these other things
and,
that
and
are happening.
And to cut you off, the reference to 84, the Olympics are in L.A.
The Olympics, 84, mm-hmm. Tom Bradley, how he changed the city, how he inspired people, mm-hmm. you know, not just as a man of color, but as a man of vision, mm-hmm. I mean, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Are there takeaways 25 years later?
I hope the takeaway, almost like you said, more than anything, is the humanity of individuals mm-hmm. and not the broad painting. I mean, there were mm-hmm. things that I saw on television 25 years ago that I had a very immediate, very visceral response to without a sense of context. Now, even with context, I or anybody may walk away and go, well, you know what, I still feel the same way, mm-hmm. but can I at least see the complicated nature of how those things were arrived to? So what we don't want to do, what I'm not trying to do is say, well, you know, LA is Ferguson or Cincinnati or is Baltimore. Or say that this individual, that's all they are. Mm-hmm. What you saw then is all they are now. But hopefully for people to walk away and go, oh, you know what, I can see the complicated nature. I can see that this person arrived to a circumstance or quite frankly is removed from a circumstance because they are a human being. I think we're gonna break hearts, but I really hope at the same time we do lift spirits.
Yeah. American Crime is doing remarkably well.
We cannot say enough about the individuals who've been on that show and helped sustain us and the kinds of conversations we've been able to have about, you know, frankly, very painful, difficult social, political issues.
The thing I love about you, and I say this to you, to your face, I've said it about you 1,000 times, absent your presence, but I so regard and so respect the fact that somebody told me years ago, it's not about the work you do, it's about the work you get done. All of us are doing work, but it's the work you get done. And you're getting it done, and you're being able to tell these stories, these human dramas, again, that we all need to wrestle with. And because I know you are so serious about representing, as we say in the hood, you always believe in representing. How does it feel when you get pushback for representing? The Guerrilla Project is a wonderful project, but I've been reading, of course, some pushback. How does that feel? How do you process getting pushback when your whole modus operandi is to represent?
It's, you know, I would never say that negativity is ever easy to deal with, mm-hmm. or that you know, as much as you want to remove yourself from things, that things don't come to you. But I think negativity has got to be the first thing that you learn to deal with, mm-hmm. because otherwise you're never going to get anywhere. But I wouldn't be sitting here if other people hadn't given me the opportunity, or quite frankly, many opportunities, to try to tell any story in particular. And over those years, to be able to tell stories like Red Tails, to be able to tell stories like 12 Years, to be able to work with people like Lupita or Regina or whatever. For me personally, I would feel somewhat irresponsible if at some point I didn't open that up. And not just with people like Frida, but people like Richard Cabral or Bettino Martinez or anyone that has an experience that's somewhat different than mine. That's difficult when you're looking at individuals and they cannot see their experience in other people's experience. It's difficult for anyone. It's also difficult, you know, honestly, when it was coming from very young people, because, you know, I've got kids. Mm-hmm. And I want them to understand their experience. I want them to understand, I believe W.E.B. Du Bois called it, you know, our particular troubles. Mm-hmm. You know, and our troubles are very particular. But at that same time, if I'm not creating some kind of space where they're going to hopefully 5, 6, 10 years from now, the other individuals who feel comfortable and feel appropriate telling their story, then I think I've done something wrong. Because I got to tell you, with 3 shows, with American Crime, Guerrilla, Let It Fall, for me, I think there's a lot of space in there for a lot of representation.
Is there comedians who've told jokes about this, that the Academy Award is almost a curse for Negroes? But it seems that either the award has worked for you, or put another way, you have made the award work for you.
I understand exactly what you're saying. And I would say almost for anybody, that award. I mean, look, that it's the pinnacle of peer review. Mm-hmm. So what do you do next? I was very fortunate because the day after the Academy Awards that morning, I had to get up, get on an airplane, and this is not hyperbole. Mm-hmm. The day after, get up that morning, get on an airplane, fly to Texas, and start our last week of prep for the first season of American Crime. Mm-hmm. So there was not time to even compartmentalize to the positive, to the negative, what that meant. It was showing up in Texas with a lot of amazing actors, mm-hmm. Felicity, Tim Hutton, Regina. You know, at that time, you know, Tim had an Oscar. Mm-hmm. Felicity had been nominated for an Academy Award. Regina is one of the best of the best. They didn't really care, mm-hmm. quite frankly. What I had, they wanted to know, what are we doing on Monday, how are we getting it done?
I am so proud to know you and honored by your work, and thank you for coming to see us, my
Absolutely.
Friend.
Absolutely.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Julian Lennon is, of course, the son of John Lennon, a successful musician in his own right. He was nominated for a Best New Artist Grammy in 1986. He's also a photographer, environmentalist, and a new author. He's co-written a children's book called Touch the Earth, which deals with the consequences of water pollution.
Touch the Earth is part of the work he's been doing with his White Feather Foundation. Julian, good to have you on this program, sir.
Thank you very much, Tavis.
Tell me about the foundation, first of all.
Well, it's a bit of a long story, but it initially arose from a meeting I had that came out of the blue while I was touring in Australia. Uh-huh. And I was in Adelaide, and I got a phone call from the hotel saying, excuse me, Mr. Lennon, there's a group of about 30 to 50 people down in the lobby of the hotel with an Aboriginal tribe and a couple of camera crews. Mm-hmm. I said, you're joking, right? He said, no, we're being very serious. Could you come and, you know, take care of this? And I'm going, what am I going to take care of? So I go down and as I walk into the lobby area, they're in a sort of semicircle with the indigenous tribe, mm-hmm. Called the Murning in the middle, and this woman, elder, who was the elder, the tribe's elder, mm-hmm. one of the tribe's elder, woman walks up to me with both hands, and presents me with a white feather, which is a male swan's white feather, which mm-hmm. is about yay big, and said to me. Can you help us? You have a voice. The backstory to this is, of course, that is that Dad said on the rare occasion that I saw him, you know, if something happens to me, then to let you know that I was that he would be all right, or that we would all were gonna be all right, would be in the form of a white feather. So, you know, you see white feathers on a daily basis, pretty much. But being presented like that, directly like that, from, you know, one of the oldest indigenous tribes in the world, that was goosebumps through the roof right there. And so it really was a question of sort of, either just remaining a rock and roller or stepping up to the plate.
Yeah.
And I'd heard a bit about their history, their past. So I spent 10 years making a documentary about them, with a few friends. And at the end of it, which is called Whale Dreamers, by the way, mm-hmm. at the end of it, you know, we thought, well, if this makes any money whatsoever, then I want it to go back to the tribe to keep their culture alive and to keep them protected, because there was a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that at that particular point in time was to do it through a foundation. So the director and myself were throwing ideas on the table, and logically the White Feather Foundation came up. And initially it was just a vehicle purely to get any profit from the film back to the tribe. It was only years later, really, and I thought kind of that was it, mm-hmm. you know, all right, back to the rock and roll, get on with it.
Yeah.
And it was only after sort of social media really came into play, and I put a website up, you know, expressing what we were doing, that I really started getting a lot more emails, mm-hmm. requesting for help. It was overwhelming, in fact. And I had to really think about that and what was important to me, what stood out to me, what could I take care of, what would I want to take care of if that was the position that I was in? What would I choose to go to help? And I was invited out a few years ago by a friend called Scott Harrison, who started an organization called Charity Water, who have gone on to bring clean water to, I mean, literally millions. And I was invited with him to Ethiopia on one of his trips, where we ventured all over the country to look at scenarios where there was no clean water, where they were in the process of building wells, and where they had thriving communities, you know, which was beautiful to see. And so we did a campaign with him for a clean water well. And that really touched me. It was the first trip I'd ever been on like that. And at the same time, within the same time period, I was able to go to Kenya to see part of the Millennium Projects, what was going on there. And they were dealing with health and education and also schools. Mm-hmm. So we spent a fair amount of time going to the health clinics, going to the schools, listening to the kids and the girls' schools, especially asking them what they need. And so White Feather has embarked on all of those issues, mm-hmm. clean water, health and education, and also the protection of indigenous tribes from all over the globe.
So I'm glad you took that meeting then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got that right.
I'm glad you went downstairs and took the meeting.
Oh, my God.
And accepted the White Feather.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's been, I'm joined at the hip now. It's forever part of what I do.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You said it was goosebumps through the roof, but I can only imagine what that must have felt like to have had your father tell you that this would be the sign and then...
Well, I have to say that it was a pretty weird one.
Yeah,
I mean, especially because, you know, I would have been anywhere between, 10 and my early teens when he would have told me that. So it would have been quite a weird thing to say. I remember him saying it and I thought, well, that's a bit odd. Yeah. And I told my mum, Cynthia, and she went,
sure.
Well, that's a bit odd. You know, but lo and behold, 20 years later and really, really beyond taken aback.
Yeah. Tell me about the, you've laid out what the foundation does, so I'm glad I asked
that question.
So I know all the work that you do. Yeah. Tell me specifically about this children's book, Touch the Earth.
I'll come around to I always tend to, mm-hmm. Everything I do is connected to the White Feather Foundation.
Right.
And I was actually, I'd met a friend, Bart, who we were going to talk about putting a biography together because I was worried that time was flying by, mm-hmm. which it is. And a lot of my friends have passed away and, who knows when. And so initially we were talking about biography, then Bart was, sort of delved into all the work that I was doing. And he said, well, you've got all this stuff going on. You write songs about the environment and the humanitarian issues. Mm-hmm. You've made documentaries about this stuff, you've started the White Feather Foundation, but have you done anything for the kids?
Mm.
And I said, I've done some animated TV shows and a couple of CDs for charity for kids here and there, but nothing mm-hmm. directly from me. And he said, well, what about that? And I said, well, I think it's a great idea. I said, as long as we can incorporate everything of what I do mm-hmm. is part and parcel of it. So a year ago, we just started writing and decided that it had to have... environmental elements to it, and it had to be reminiscent of days gone by when I remember, at nap time or bedtime, mm-hmm. you'd sit with your mother or your grandmother, and you'd be arm in arm, and you'd go through the pages of the book, and you'd go on an adventure, and it was such a fond memory of that sort of time of bonding and nurturing. Mm-hmm. Which, we see little of today with today's technology, kind of stealing that a little bit with iPads and everything else. And so that was really, really important for me to bring that back And, you know, to be able to do it in, with beautiful illustrations.
Sure, I must say the illustrations
she's
are
gorgeous. Done an amazing, yeah, yeah. Smiljana did an amazing mm-hmm. job. And it's a very simple book, but it tells a beautiful little story. And, to be able to bring in education a little bit, to get the kids to really start, because I think at this age, sort of the threes and onwards, it's a sort of, a lot of people call it the why age. Mm-hmm. Well, why is the grass green? Why is mm-hmm. the sea polluted? Why is the plastic there? And I think that's really good at opening the conversation for kids and empowering the kids into understanding what's going on in their life and around them. But also, not a bad reminder for yeah. the parents, too.
For as little time as you spent with your father, it is amazing to me that you embody so much of his spirit of using your artistic gift to love and serve other people.
Well, thank you for that. But I think it's more so than that. It's my mother that gave me sure. that heart. Mm-hmm. Because after seeing what her life was like and yeah. how she'd been treated, mm-hmm. The one thing for me was that shouldn't happen to anybody, right. And so empathy began early at home. Yeah. And I've the only thing I wanted to do was make Mum proud.
Yeah.
My journey. And yeah. so I try to be the best that I can be and try to do the best that I can do through this journey called life.
Yeah, well, you're doing it, and I'm honored to have you on
Thank
the program,
Thank you
Julian.
So much.
The book is called Touch the Earth by Julian Lennon. Wonderful illustration, as I said earlier. Julian, good to have you on, my friend.
My pleasure.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.